Coming up on Broadway Videos this week on Broadway, we talk with Broadway Con's event creator, Melissa Anelli. We've reviewed The Color Purple, West Side Story, Fiddler on the Roof, Once Upon a Mattress, Annie, China Doll, Lazarus, Invisible Thread, School of Rock, and Motherstruck. This week on Broadway for Sunday, December 20th, 2015. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this evening, we have Peter Felicia, Michael Portantier, and Carrie Purcell. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Hello, Peter.
Good evening.
As well as all your other credits, Peter, you also are a playwright, and Adam Skiff's The New Christmas Carol opened up in Clinton, Iowa. So tell us about that.
Well, let's get the introductions in first, and then we can come back to it.
Absolutely.
I don't want to keep them waiting.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael's a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears to Talkin' Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good evening, Michael.
Hi, happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you. Also with us is Carrie Purcell. Carrie is a staff writer and features editor at Playbill.com. She can be followed on Twitter at Carrie Purcell and at her blog, CarriePurcell.com. Hello, Carrie.
Hello.
With us this evening, we have a very special guest. Melissa Anelli is with us. Melissa is the event creator of something very new coming up called Broadway Con. And people outside of the Broadway industry might be familiar with these type of cons. The most recent, of course, being the Santa Con, which may not have a...
Not exactly the same thing.
not exactly the same thing. So, Melissa, thank you for joining us on a Sunday evening. Why don't you tell us in your own words, what is Broadway Con and why should we all go to it?
Oh, okay. So Broadway Con is the kind of event that if I had heard was happening when I was 16, I would have lost my mind. And it's basically what we do. And at the company, we make events that our 16-year-old selves would have loved. So Broadway Con is the answer to a Comic Con for fans, with a couple of key differences. The company that created it, my company, Mischief Management, we are really intense on making sure that it is from a fan's perspective. That most comic conventions that you go to these days are principally organized around standing in line and waiting for autographs, paying for those autographs, paying for photo opportunities, which is something that is, you know, has a certain value and is certainly something that that a lot of people go and do. But we're more interested in the content side, and this is where the Broadway element was such a great fit, because people in theater know and love and understand and value the idea that when you have all this talent in a room together and people who are appreciating that talent, the best way you can spend your time is to be exploring and having fun and talking and getting to interact in a way that can't really happen at the stage door and isn't really the current theatrical structure isn't really built for. So we're looking to give people just the time of their lives over the entire weekend.
You know, I totally neglected. I breezed right over the details. It's coming up January 22nd to the 24th, 2016. So just about a month from now.
Don't remind me.
Oh, you getting a lot of sleep these days?
Yeah, well, sleep. What sleep? What sleep for anyway?
It's going to be at the Hilton in Midtown, and fans can get over to BroadwayCon.com, BroadwayCon.com, to check it out and get tickets and things like that. So I'm sorry I interrupted you, but it sounds like, you know, I don't know if you know Jennifer Ashley Tepper, but, you know, our 16-year-old selves living the Broadway dream, that would be Jennifer's life, you know. You know, you get to be Jennifer for a day to go to Broadway Con.
It's interesting. The very first person we went to said, you know, people have told me left and right, up and down, because I come from the Harry Potter community where I wrote a book about Harry Potter. J.K. Rowling wrote the foreword for it. I used to run a website. I mean, I still do, but it's secondary. About, you know, called the Leaky Cauldron, and LeakyCon, which is a Harry Potter website, is what started this company, and it's what started us exploring what could happen when conventions were really run by the people who go to them. You know, and as soon as we stepped into this world, people kept telling me, you must meet Jennifer Ashley Tepper. She is you for Broadway. And so I said, okay. And so as soon as we met her, we brought her on as a consultant on this event. And she, Anthony Rapp, is a co-creator of this event as well. And that actually happened because we've been friends since the early days of Rent. I was one of the kids sleeping outside the theater in 1996 for tickets. We just kept in touch over all that time. And so he's heard me talking and talking and talking about what it is we do at Mischief with GeekyCon, LeakyCon, you know. And we had brought him to one of our events. And when the weekend was over and he saw, you know, he was feeling exhausted, but he kept saying he was exhausted and fulfilled by it, that he had had so much interaction with people that he's not used to, you know, having all that time to really connect with fans. And we said, okay, great. While you're still buzzing with all this, we have this idea. We want to do this for Broadway. And he turned around to us and said, whatever you want, whatever you need, let's do this. I'm in. And that's how it started.
And it's also a benefit for Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS as well.
I don't want to say that it's the same thing as like a Gypsy of the Year.
Oh no, like of course not.
But we do Mischief Management, even though it isn't a non-for-profit company, has done a great deal for charity over the years. We've only been incorporated for 4 years, and we've already raised or been responsible for primarily donating more than $300,000 to associated causes. The Harry Potter Alliance, Oxfam, NaNoWriMo, a lot of causes. And it's a huge part when you're a fan. I think fandom and charity really go hand in hand, and you just feel like when you're part of a community that it's very important to give back to it. So as soon as we said, okay, well, we absolutely have to try and give to this community that we're entering and connect in it in the right ways, and BCEFA was a huge part of that.
So tell us about, you know, January 22nd, where I'm rolling up to the Hilton. What am I going to see?
A lot of costumes, probably. I want to count the elphabos over the weekend. That's my goal.
I'll be wearing one.
The rotating. Excellent. Actually, cosplay is one of the things we're most excited about because the Broadway world is so ripe for it, and people have been working on their costumes for a year. So I'm really excited about that. You're going to see a lot of really passionate fans getting to meet each other from all over the country and getting to spend a weekend just completely immersed. One of the best things about these events is that you walk around and you know any single person you meet shares that thing. You can go up to them and freak out about your favorite line in Hamilton or, you know, the off-Broadway show you saw 4 years ago that you can't get out of your head. They'll understand where that passion comes from. And it creates a comfort and an excitement and a real kind of like loving atmosphere that we try and bolster with making sure that you're spending your weekend not standing in line for autographs, but, you know, going to panels, going to entertainments, going to workshops, and, you know, and really just expanding your knowledge and love. So you're going to see a lot of excitement, a lot of people singing, most likely. That tends to be a thing that happens anyway at any event we do, and so you can just imagine what's going to happen at a Broadway themed event. On the first day, we're also kicking it off with a big opening. We're actually writing a mini musical, which, you know, said only ever by people who don't like sleeping. So there's a lot. One of our big goal when we create the schedule, when we create the event, is to make people feel when they open the schedule that they need a time turner to do the kind of things to do everything that they want to do. And the schedule, which is already online, it's only about 80% public. There's a lot private that we still haven't announced yet. And it's already, that's the reaction we're getting. So we're really excited.
What is this thing, Hamilton, that you say?
Well, let me tell you. Talk about sleeping on the street. Let me tell you, this I haven't had this kind of like fandom feeling about a show since Rent. But yeah, the entire leading cast of Hamilton is going to come for a big celebratory Q&A. Playbill, who are our partners, our wonderful, wonderful partners at Playbill, are leading that discussion. Hamilton is the show. Okay, can I tell a quick story?
Sure.
My friends said to me last January, "Hey, Melissa, we've got tickets for the next Lin-Manuel Miranda musical. Can you commit to this date in March?" And me, being, you know, a busy person, was like, "I can't commit to breakfast tomorrow. I'll get tickets. Just don't worry." Within two weeks, I was regretting that statement, of course. So then the day comes, and I go down to the theater, and they're taunting me mercilessly online. I go down to the theater, and I'm trying to, like, win the lottery so that we all get to see it together. Well, while I'm waiting, this happens to be the day that building collapsed downtown.
Oh, yeah.
So they canceled the show, and so they don't get to see the show. And the next day, I waited in cancellation. Instead of working in my office, I actually sat in the lobby of the Public and worked so that I could wait in cancellation. And then, so I ended up being, after all their taunting, I ended up being the first one. And so it was so amazing. And I wasn't expecting it the way people are kind of expecting it now because of all the hype. I was so blown away that I went down the next day and waited in line for my friends and just kept putting their names into the cancellation because I needed somebody to speak to about it. And at the same day that I saw it was the day that we heard back from Jonathan Groff about being at BroadwayCon, and he actually emailed me from intermission. And I remember that he's like the first person I had my big Hamilton reaction to, you know? Anyway, it's very connected with this show. But the wonderful thing about it is that something that's inspiring this level of fandom, that's why BroadwayCon exists, because we had, you know, I met Anthony back in whatever, and then I went off, did my whole, you know, the Harry Potter career that led to these conventions. Then, because I knew Anthony, the Broadway convention seemed possible, and it all is kind of circular. And now here we are at the kind of fandom that we maybe haven't even seen since Rent, possibly with Wicked, you know, since. So it's exciting.
Well, I'm pretty sure you're up to the level of Jennifer Ashley Tepper fandom, you know.
Now, I don't know as much as she knows so much. It's so one of the first things we also did was steal her research assistant when her research assistant Sierra Fox is now our assistant at Mischief. She's been working even more hours a day than I do on making sure that this is all going to be wonderful. And the level of knowledge that she has by far surpasses, you know, but it's wonderful because we're working, we're the kind of people that go to this event, you know what I mean? And that's always the kind of event we want to create.
Well, BroadwayCon is coming up. We'll have links to it on our show page at BroadwayRadio.com. But you can visit BroadwayCon at BroadwayCon.com. And for our listeners out there, I know that a number of our listeners have emailed us and told us that they are coming into town for BroadwayCon. We're going to try to get together a little coffee for Broadway Radio listeners as well. And Peter, you're going to be on the panel at BroadwayCon, on one of the panels, aren't you?
Yes, I will. Panel on Why Didn't Shows Run? What happened to them? Was it marketing? Was it bad reviews? Was it bad word of mouth? Could anything have been done to save them? Anything like that? So that's what I'll be talking about.
Was there any way to save Blonde and the Thunderbird? All right, folks, look that up for your trivia question, Blonde and the Thunderbird. But so, Melissa, thank you for joining us on a Sunday night, and we will talk with you at BroadwayCon.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
Good night.
Right at the top of the show, I mentioned that Peter has a show open called Adam's Gifts. And so, Peter, why don't you tell us about the opening there?
Well, actually, this is a very, very, very different version of A Christmas Carol. When you're a theater critic, you do see A Christmas Carol a lot in December. You see the inevitable play, the inevitable musical, the one-person show, and the inevitable update. And in the updates, people are calling each other Scrooge and Cratchit, and nobody's saying, gee, that's funny, you know, that you have the same names as the Dickens characters, even though this is 2015. Nobody says that. In all these updates, the protagonist will say, Christmas, bah humbug. Nobody says bah humbug now. So when I saw a show called Scrooge and the Spirits, which starred a character as Ebenezer Scrooge, I was thinking, who's named Ebenezer in this part of in this time frame? Nobody's named Ebenezer today. And he said bah humbug too, and I thought, this is wrong. Is there any way to update A Christmas Carol where this would not be a problem? Well, I think I found a way, but anyway, so I'm not going to tell you what that way is, but what I will tell you that's so interesting about this production in Clinton, Iowa, it's only a five-character show. We have a ghost. We don't have a ghost of Christmas past, Christmas present, Christmas future. The feeling is that back in Scrooge's day, yes, indeed, there weren't that many terrible people around, so you could afford to have three ghosts work on each candidate. But now there's just too many stinkers around. One ghost has to do everything. So that so we have the ghost, and we have a guy named William Pront, who is our Scrooge character. We have Jason Romano, who is our Bob Cratchit character. And we have Lisa Panewski, who is his ex-wife, and they have a son, Adam. So it all gets very complicated from there, needless to say, as well it should. But here's what got complicated in Iowa. The woman who was cast as Lisa, the Mrs. Cratchit character, wasn't able to complete the run. And unlike A Christmas Carol, this is a show where the Mrs. Cratchit character has a lot to do. She's very, very much in the show. And so the director called up a pair of identical twins. He knew who were actresses and said, you take these scenes, you take the other scene. Is this incredible?
The show behind the show.
Is this unbelievable? I've never heard of this happening. Maybe it does.
You mean so each one would have less to learn?
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Less block, less to learn. And I had no idea this was happening. You know, I mean, it was so funny. At the end of the show, we're all piling on stage to do the talk back. And I'm not even paying attention to who's sitting here, there, or anywhere. And suddenly he says, well, why don't you all introduce yourselves? So she said, my name is blah, blah, blah. I played Lisa. The next person said, my name is blah, blah, blah. I played Lisa. And I thought, this is like to tell the truth. You know, my name is. So it was so bizarre, you know. And so that's something that I think really is unprecedented, is at least in my world. And I've seen a lot of shows, needless to say, that maybe they've tricked me over the years. Anyway, they did a wonderful job. I was so pleased and proud of them all for doing this. And the audience seemed to like it quite a bit. So I think if we all live long enough, we'll see more productions of Adam's Gifts.
That is wonderful. That's so great to come out with stories of success and intrigue.
Improvisation.
Improvisation, right. Yeah.
Oh, and we have so much of that all the time. All right. So let's get on to our reviews. I guess last week it was that Peter gave us his review of The Color Purple, and Carrie, Michael, and I got a chance to see it. So, Carrie, why don't you start us off with The Color Purple?
Well, let's just say one word. Cynthia.
Mm, yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Where has she been my whole life? Because I am in love. She was amazing. I mean, I know a lot of people in the audience and in the press were very excited about Jennifer Hudson, as was I, but Cynthia, who plays the lead character, wow. I've never heard such a voice come out of such a tiny little person before in my life. I did not live here when the first production ran, and I actually hadn't even heard the cast recording, so I was completely new to the musical. I had read the book in school, but I actually haven't even seen the movie. And I was incredibly moved by the production. I was a little confused by the chairs hanging from the ceiling. The backdrop. I spent a lot of time at intermission trying to find the symbolism of them with my friend at the show. But I thought that the small cast and was very effective. That the orchestra was beautiful, and I was just really, really touched by how the show addressed a lot of dark, violent, horrible subjects, but still managed to at least leave at least me departing on a very uplifted note by how strong this character was and how much she survived. I also love the simple costumes and the vibrant colors at the end with all the pants that were made for the characters. And I did think Jennifer Hudson was very good, but I just, even when she was, when Chuck Avery was doing her push the button number at the bar, I was watching Cynthia react to it more than I was watching Jennifer, I'll admit, because she was just so compelling on that stage. I'm very glad it's back on Broadway. I know a lot of people have said it's too soon, but from what I've heard from my peers, this is a very, very different presentation of the material than it was 10 years ago. And I think it's a story that really should be seen and heard and honored as much as possible.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
I completely agree about Cynthia, and I think one of the most wonderful things about her performance is that she looked so young in the beginning scenes. Anyway, she had that wonderful innocence to her that really, I thought, it brought a tremendous amount to the show. But also, yes, her voice is extraordinary, and her acting. I really was very, very impressed with Jennifer Hudson. Largely because, I mean, really, absolutely no stage experience whatsoever.
She was in the Hair Benefit concert back in, I think it was 2004 or 2005.
I think I was going to just say, I she was also in Best Little Whorehouse in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Not no experience, but very little experience, and especially with delivering dialogue. I thought she really was. She seemed very much at home, and I thought she had a lot of poise. And I really was. I was a little worried about it, to be honest. But I was very impressed, and I thought she came through beautifully. And we can't. We should not mention Danielle Brooks as mm-hmm. Sophia, because she was wonderful. Yeah. Also, I had very mixed reaction to the production. Loved it better than the original, in the sense that, as I think I mentioned several times, I thought the original production was horrifically overamplified to the point where it destroyed almost everything good that was happening on that stage. I did get to see the original twice, and I got back to see it when Fantasia did it, and she was quite extraordinary, but still there was that problem. I thought this is a show that's flinging itself at you from an audio standpoint rather than trying to draw you in. And I think that's bad for any show, but especially one that's so much about characters and their inner lives. So in that sense, I think this one was a great improvement. But I have to say, there were so many things about the direction that really distracted me. Carrie, the only thing I could come up with for the chairs is maybe it's supposed to be like a place at the table, and empty chairs maybe representing the people who come in and out of her life. I don't know.
At empty tables?
Couldn't
resist.
Yeah. Empty chairs at empty tables. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, one can not help recalling the original Grand Hotel, in which chairs played a huge part. But also, I'm trying to be charitable. I don't know what they meant, and I don't know what the point was. And what was this with everyone standing on chairs at regular intervals? David Laveau did that in 9. Is that some kind of law that British directors have to have people stand on chairs? I have liked a lot of what John Doyle has done. I've always gone back and forth on him, but I think, you know, basically he puts a lot of thought into things, and he's had lots of successes and certainly lots of product, but I thought this, so much of this was so idiosyncratic that I really didn't get it. I hated things like how he would there was a huge confrontation towards the end between Mr. and Seeley, and they were not looking at each other. Mr. was way upstage, and Seeley was way downstage, and they were both looking out to the audience. And that was only one example. I mean, the whole show isn't like that. It's not that people never look at each other, but there are times when they really are not. And that's another Doyle hallmark that I have never been able to understand. And I wish he would stop doing that. I don't know what it means. There were things that seemed to work against the story, like in the beginning, right after Nettie gets thrown out, we see Seeley go to the mailbox to see if there's a letter from Nettie. And Mister says something like, if you go near that mailbox again, I'm going to kill you. So she never does. But since there is no mailbox on stage and really no set whatsoever other than the chairs, the way this was indicated was that Nettie came on stage and held out a letter, which Seeley then reached out for and almost took until she was stopped by Mister. But what that did was destroyed the whole – the whole reveal at the end when we find out that Nettie's been writing letters to Seeley for years and Mister has not given any of them to her and has kept them from her. So that was, I thought, a tremendous mistake. In the original production, for all its flaws, I seem to remember that Seeley's children as adults were not revealed until the very end of the show, and it made a tremendous emotional impact. But in this case, we saw them earlier, and I thought it really dulled the impact of that. There were other moments when I felt like Doyle was working against the emotions of the piece. And, you know, on the one hand, I like that it wasn't manipulative, but I think he went too far in the other direction.
At the performance you were at, were people laughing at some of the, or the audience members laughing at some of the allusions to rape, like when Mister was hitting on Nettie right after Seeley married him, when Nettie came to visit Seeley? Because that really took me out of the show and upset me greatly at the performance I went to.
And were you, and
it
were you
at mine?
And did you, Peter, did you say did or didn't?
Did not.
No, but
there was
what
a
about,
lot of laughter. It was,
but well, the I seem to recall some of that, but what I really noticed was that the lesbian kiss did not get the reaction that I would have hoped for.
That was the only thing I wanted more of, was I wanted a little more passion and romance between Seeley and Shug, because it was one brief sweet kiss, a beautiful song, and then
right.
From what I recall of the book, there was a lot more about her sexuality.
Well, as I recall, though, this production had a great deal more of that than the last Broadway production. So at least they're moving
in the right
direction. And I don't want to overstate it. There were only a few people who, like, shouted or sort of screamed when the two women kissed. And, you know, I'll just chalk that up to nervousness and immaturity. But it did bother me anyway.
There was none of that at the performance I went to, but there was a lot of laughter with the allusions to rape and sexual abuse. And I find that deeply, deeply disturbing, and wanted to just sit all of those people down and talk to them after the show.
I know.
That can't be nerves. That's ignorance, in my opinion. And I hope that the show educated them a little bit, because there's a lot to learn from that.
Yes. Agreed.
So the chairs confounded me as well. And I just thought about Dr. Zhivago. Do you remember Dr. Zhivago, the wall of chairs?
Oh, right. Yes.
The curtain of chairs and all the other stuff that's happened there. And so I went and looked deeper into this, and John Doyle was the designer of the production.
Yes.
And I can't figure it out. I don't remember. He's also listed as the designer of the production in the Sweeney Todd he did in 2005, but I don't remember any erstwhile chairs there that were.
No, but he does seem to like to hang things on walls.
They used the chairs. I only saw in one scene as people picked up chairs off the wall and use them and put them back. But if it was a device, it was not consistently used.
Right.
And it seemed strange. For the most part, I thought that the direction was pretty good and solid. Because I tend to go into John Doyle things saying, oh no, what are we going to have here? But I really enjoyed this production. I thought the cast was outstanding. Some of the things that are in the producer's area that were interesting to me is that Kelsey Grammer is a producer on this.
What?
Kelsey Grammer is a producer.
I did not know that.
And well, that's surprising.
So, Peter, can you tell me, has anybody ever been a producer of a show that they're performing in a different show at a different theater at the same time?
Well, I don't know about performing. Michael, you have an answer? Because what immediately came to mind for me was Julie Stein, a composer who produced and probably was producing Mr. Wonderful. Yeah, that was still running when his own show, Bells Are Ringing, opened in 1956. So, yes, that at least that. Michael, do you have an answer for a performer, though?
No, but haven't we read recently of more high profile actors producing? Didn't Tom Hanks do a couple of things? And I can't think of who else.
I guess you're right. Yeah, absolutely.
But can I think of someone? I mean, at this moment, Kelsey Grammer is not in Finding Neverland. But
this is true.
But presumably he will be when because he's coming back. Although they just changed the date.
Yeah, they changed the date again.
But I'm sure, I imagine Color Purple will still be running then, so he will be. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a very interesting thing. And I think Kelsey's a very interesting person. He just, okay. He's off stage. He's very different than...
He's been lovely to me.
No. Always very lovely. Always very lovely, but his politics don't seem to line up with the things that he does on stage.
That was my surprise as well.
And he's very conservative Republican, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. But it just seems that the projects he gets behind are very not in line with that.
Well, maybe he'll fulfill my wish of the next GOP debate beginning with someone singing "Send in the Clowns." They all climb out of one little car and go to their podiums.
All right, so let's move on to the Washington, D.C., where they do have GOP debates. And Michael got a chance, just got back from two buses and a train from D.C., and where you got a chance to see West Side Story. So, Michael, why don't you tell us about West Side Story?
Well, I won't say it was the best production I've ever seen, only because I seem to remember, it's really long ago, but I saw a production at the Jones Beach Marine Theater, really in the 80s, that may have been better from what I remember, that had Christine Andreas and Barry Williams from the Brady Bunch, of all people. But this is a beautiful, beautiful production, and I'll, for the sake of argument, I'll say it's the best I've ever seen. It's at the Signature in Arlington, Virginia, and it's directed by Matthew Gardner with choreography by Parker S. I'm not sure how you pronounce it. ESSE, Parker S-E-S-E. Based on the original choreography by Jerome Robbins, there was a lot that I noticed that was, you know, familiar, especially in the dance at the gym and Cool, whereas, for example, the Rumble seemed to be a little more original to me. And he did a superb job, this choreographer, however you say his name, not the least of which because the Signature, it's often set up differently. Every time I've gone to see something there, the configuration is somewhat different, but it's usually some kind of a thrust. And in this case, it was set up, I would say, very much like Circle in the Square when it's not in the round, when it's three-quarter thrust. Imagine Circle in the Square, except much smaller in terms of the seating capacity, not necessarily the stage space. The stage space is quite large. But imagine choreographing West Side Story in a three-quarter thrust configuration. It was brilliantly done. I can't tell you how great it was. The choreography itself, but just the way that the patterns kept changing and people kept moving and facing different directions so that the audience, no matter where you were sitting, you felt like you were seeing the whole show. Really, really superb job. Matthew Gardner, the director, also just in terms of the working with the actors and keeping the show moving, the pacing was perfect. There was a 16 or 17 piece orchestra that was up above on a catwalk, and they were great. Only the strings, I would say, were a little slightly undernourished, but that's always the case with the strings, I guess. And the cast was, I mean, first of all, they all looked barely out of their teens. So that, again, helped, as it did with Cynthia Erivo in Color Purple. The Tony Austin Colby was absolutely perfect in terms of singing, acting, and looks. Maria was Mary Joanna Griso, and she, her singing was not at the highest level, but I want to tell you, she was that person on stage there. I felt like I was watching this Maria person. Just beautiful and sincere and completely into every moment of what was happening. Also great were Bernardo, Sean Ewing, Anita Natasha Diaz, who's done the part before, and I had never seen her though, and she was superb. And Riff was Max Clayton, and he really, again, it was like it was that person on stage. So I'm, you know, I was just recently discussing with a friend about how in we both feel that West Side Story is in our, like our top three musicals ever written, but neither of us had ever seen a production that really did it justice. And I told him about the Joan Speech one, which was so long ago, and I can't really authoritatively say how, you know, again, how good it was, because it was so long ago. But this one, I now feel like it was absolutely worth the trip to Washington for me to see this. And if anyone can possibly get there, I recommend that you do so.
Great. Well, it's extended through January 31st, and it's at the Signature in Arlington. We'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. So let's move forward into Carrie is the only one here that has had a chance to see Fiddler on the Roof, which opens tonight, so we can talk about it. So Carrie, why don't you tell us about Fiddler?
It was a really interesting experience. I'd never seen the musical live before, but I think I know every word from watching the movie repeatedly as a child. A friend of mine confessed that he is Jewish and had never seen the musical before and didn't know the story, and he was afraid his mitzvah certificate would be taken away from him. And I shamed him by saying, this shiksa over here knows every lyric and can play every song on the piano. It was so special seeing Danny Burstein play Tevye. It was so moving to see him in that role. He's just radiant with happiness on that stage. I had seen him perform If I Were a Rich Man at the press day, and that alone was extremely moving. And he was just wearing, you know, jeans and a sweater that day. But seeing him in costume and just embodying that role, the love and the frustration and the confusion that Tevye goes through was so beautifully portrayed by Danny. And I've been a fan of him for a long time, as most of us have. And it's really, really special to see him lead a show. The casting was a little unusual. I had never seen Jessica Hecht in a musical before. Her Golda was really interesting to me. She was very, very tired and very short and impatient with Tevye. But then I was kind of confused by that choice at first, especially since, you know, we interviewed Jessica on this podcast and she's this lovely, kind woman. So it was kind of like, wait, what's happening? Watching her, you know, yell at Danny Burstein. But it was, I could see later why that choice was made, because it all came together in Do You Love Me? And that was one of my favorite scenes of the show, watching the two of them go through that, like communicating for what was probably one of the first times in an emotional way. I adored all three sisters. All three were wonderful. Alexandra Silber, Samantha Massel, and Melanie Moore. And I loved how they did Matchmaker, which they had told me was that Sheldon Harnick had told them, this is unlike anything I've ever seen before, because it is a very different way to begin the song and set up the conflict of these three girls. What everyone has been buzzing about is the framing device in the musical, which Do you three want me to spoil it for you, or have you read about it?
I think we know.
It's already happened.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty much out there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, just checking. It begins with Danny on stage in a 21st century-looking coat, and I believe a suitcase as well, if I recall correctly, looking at a sign that says Anatevka. And then he takes off the coat, untucks the prayer shawl, covers up his head, and begins tradition. And then the show ends with, in typical Bart Scherer fashion, a slow, solemn, symbolic processional of the cast. I've noticed that happens in many of his musicals. And Danny, they're all leaving Anatevka, and Danny disappears and then reappears on stage in the coat again. And wearing the red coat and with his head uncovered, goes to join the procession, carrying Tevye's cart where Tevye had been standing. And I understand Bart's intention for that was to show the cycle of time and of culture, and to also highlight the modern day refugee crisis. And I know people have felt very mixed about this choice. And I read in the Times that Sheldon Harnick wasn't the biggest fan of it at first, but it didn't bother me. One of the reasons why I love Bart's work is that he does bring in present day social and political conflicts so beautifully. And it works, in my opinion. There is a huge crisis going on. And one of the ways that people like arts, people like us can learn from musicals and from art, and it worked for me. And I know that it's a big change for people who have seen this musical who knows how many times. That should be a contest who's seen Fiddler on the Roof the most. And another big shock for a lot of people is that it doesn't utilize or pay homage to Jerome Robbins' choreography. Mm-hmm. But this new choreography is fascinating to watch, very fluid, very, very earthy, very in a way, if it can be, with the beards and the hats and the long coats, very sensual. And I loved it. I thought that the sets could have been a bit more, and I thought that the stage could have been put to use a bit more. There's so much space and it is pretty bare at times, but if the goal is to present an emotionally and politically moving and educational musical, then it did its job, very much so.
All right. So we are going to be seeing it, Peter, Michael, and I will be seeing it in the next couple of weeks, and we'll come back and give our takes on it as well. All right. So next up on the agenda, Peter, Michael, and Carrie got to see Transport Group's production of Once Upon a Mattress. Peter, why don't you start us off on that?
Yeah, this is a show that really surprised me, because even though I've seen it four times previously, something hit me for the first time in this production that had never hit me before. And that was the fact that because stagecraft in 1959 was not as advanced as it is now, that a lot of shows had to have in-ones. In-ones, the term used when people are down at the front of the stage performing a number, there's a curtain that's been pulled behind them, and the reason for this is that the scenery is being changed behind them. We're a little more sophisticated today, but we are talking about an off-Broadway production that isn't very well floating with money. So they did the best they could. But the thing is that so many of these numbers are irrelevant to the action, and it sort of slows things down a bit. They're clever numbers. I mean, a young man talking to his father about the birds and the bees, wanting to know the information he needs to know. The father is mute, and so he has to do it by charades. That's a great idea for a number, but it has nothing to do with the show, really. And there are plenty of others, too, that take place in front of the curtain, and what we really want to do is get to the matter at hand, and that is the fact that Prince Dauntless desperately wants to get married. His mother, Queen Agravaine, claims that she wants him to, but we don't believe her for a second, because any princess who shows up she deems not worthy of him. And to prove it, what she does is give each one a test, which is always impossible. And the test for this new one who shows up, whom she hates more than any other because this woman is very ungainly, Princess Winifred is. She doesn't believe she's a princess because she comes from a part of the world where there are swamps. Anyway, so she devises the test that we know from the fairy tale, The Princess and the Pea, that she puts a pea under the mattress and on mattress. The show should be called Once Upon 20 Mattresses, because that's what she really puts the pea under, 20. And the point is, if indeed the pea rankles her enough while she's sleeping, well, then she's really a princess. But of course, Queen Agravaine is very, very certain that Winifred is not going to feel the pee, not under 20 mattresses. So that's our conundrum there. And when the show really sticks to that story, it really is quite delightful. And I do believe that if it were done today, it'd be 90 minutes and out, and that would be the end of it. And it would be, you know, quite lovely. Now, the question a lot of people have had over the few weeks are Jackie Hoffman's age appropriateness for this show. And for example, Carol Burnett, who first did it, was 26 when she did it, and Sarah Jessica Parker, who did it 20 years ago, was 31 then. Okay, now Jackie Hoffman is almost those two ages put together. And a lot of people say, well, she's just too old. I don't think so. I don't think the age really matters. This is a woman who wants to get married. This is a woman who heard there's an opening for a princess, and so she's going to go for it. Why does this have to be a younger person? It doesn't matter at all. So, and so I don't think that should be a barrier. Dauntless is certainly impressed with her because she did the most impossible thing. She swam the moat, and which is something, of course, that the queen hates. Yeah. So, but it's just a case that Winifred wanted to get there by hell or literally high water. So anyway, I don't see any problem with the age thing at all. And I have a feeling that after a few minutes, nobody will be bothered by the fact that she's older than we're used to here. Your eyes will probably be squinting a little because she's very, very funny and you'll be laughing so much. So that's a good possibility. Now, there's another piece of non-traditional casting here, and that comes from John Epperson, who's better known as Lipsinka in the business, a very famous female impersonator, and he plays the queen. And what's really nice under Jack Cummings' direction is that he doesn't camp it up. He doesn't overdo it. He plays the role. He just wants to do it as written, and I think does very, very well by it. So by underplaying, he gets laughs that he wouldn't have got if he were over the top. So I appreciate that. A very good production, actually. A lot of fun. Some of the music is wonderful, and the lyrics by Marshall Berry are extraordinary. No wonder Mary Rodgers and he were an item for a time. They were. Both Mary and Marshall told me that, though I will admit that Marshall claimed they were engaged, and Mary denied that, but that's another story. But it's so interesting that both of them admitted that the reason they didn't get married was because Richard Rodgers, Mary's father, didn't like him at all. So in a strange way, this is that musical, what happened to them in real life. You know, there was disapproval there from a parent. And luckily it worked out happily in Once Upon a Mattress, though I think Mary eventually came to realize it worked out pretty happily anyway by marrying Henry Gettle as opposed to Marshall, who was eccentric. And his lyrics show that, but they're also brilliant, especially in the number Shy, in which Princess Winifred claims that she's shy, and at the end she claims that she's one man shy. So there's a nice double use of the word shy there, which is really terrific. So it's hard to get to. It's not as hard as swimming a moat, I'll grant you, but getting down to getting down to the Aaron's Arts Center on Grand Street, the 14th Street bus will get you there in a while. And the F train, I guess, is the best, but there's still a 10-minute walk. Mm-hmm. But it may be worth the trip.
Easier to get to Clinton, Iowa than down there. All right. So, Carrie, what did you think about this?
The only other time I'd ever seen Once Upon a Mattress was when I was still in college in Boston, and it was done with a very flamboyantly dressed gay man playing Princess Winifred. And that was a really special experience, actually. That was almost a decade ago and before marriage equality was what it is now. So one of my favorite songs from the show, Happily Ever After, had a very different, very bittersweet meaning then. Jackie Hoffman is a tornado of hilarity, a force of nature. And frankly, I love that they've got a woman her age playing the leading role, because I believe it's Jackie's first leading role ever.
Yeah.
That was what the Times profile on her had said. And to get her to see her put all of her talents and volume and everything else to use was a real treat. And a big surprise. I love a musical where the conventional female ingenue is not presented in a typical form. And it is a really delightful show. The lyrics are very clever, and you have to absorb them, because a lot of them are very rapid fire, and then think about what they mean later, kind of in the same way I had to with Hamilton, only that time with the lyrics in front of me from the CD. Another standout cast member I thought was the actor who played Prince Dauntless. I love that he wasn't your typical dashing Prince Charming, and he and Jackie had such a sweet chemistry together. I really believed that they were falling for each other. And yes, it is not easy to get to. Thankfully, I had a friend who can read maps better than I can, or I might not have made it at all. The Lower East Side is not my best, most navigable place in the city for me. But I think there's a lot to... I mean, the show was done in, I think, 1959 on Broadway. And
correct.
It's really interesting watching it now, watching it in 2015, watching it as a loud, proud feminist, and thinking about what fairy tales are saying to people now and what happily ever after means to people. I have a 4-year-old niece who said one day while reading a book of Disney princesses that Cinderella and Snow White and Sleeping Beauty are all kind of the same because all they do is clean and stuff. And I was very proud that she noticed that at age 4. And I thought, what would she think about Once Upon a Mattress? What would she say in her completely unfiltered, very pure observations? So I think it's a delightfully performed show. The orchestra is great, and the cast is really it's charming. And I think that if you want to read into it, if you want to think about fairy tales and gender roles and all of that, you can as well. Or you can watch Jackie Hoffman own that stage, because she does.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
Well, I hadn't really been focusing on it, but now that you brought it up, I actually think that it's this version of the tale is very palatable from a modern day standpoint in terms of gender roles and in terms of Winifred being such a proactive character. When you think about it, compared to the other princesses that you mentioned, I really think she is, and that's I think one of the wonderful things about the show. I like Peter and Carrie. I had no problem with her age. I mean, first of all, the show is a musical comedy, and it's it's almost it was originally created for the adult. At the adult camp Tamament, that where Mary Rogers and those other people were, and it was the kind of like a camp style of camp almost. And then I think they expanded it beautifully for Broadway. I agree with Peter. I was struck this time more than in past viewings of the show how much filler there is, if that's the right word. It's a lot of divertissement and just numbers there for the sake of charm and comedy. I love each of those numbers individually, so I don't mind it. But they really do keep throwing in numbers like that to kind of draw out the story. As it was going through, I was thinking to myself how it could be cut to do it in one act, and I think it could be done. So maybe somebody will do that someday. But again, I love all of those numbers individually. I thought that Hunter Ryan Hurdlicka sang just beautifully. As the minstrel. Very, very, very beautifully. Mm. And this Corey Lingner, who I had never heard of before, his dancing in Very Soft Shoes as the jester, the audience just adored him, and so did I. Just beautiful, beautiful dancing. He was in On the Town. I think he was So we're talking about the very top level of ability and talent as far as dancing. I did not I did not like the casting of Jason Sweet Tooth Williams, just because to me he was the wrong type. I agree about their chemistry, but I can't quite put my finger on it. I didn't think he was the right type, and I also think that they ruined the joke of having Winifred having Jackie Hoffman wear her trademark eyeglasses as Winifred. I mean, obviously, there were no eyeglasses in the. Mm. When is it supposed to be? I don't know, the 12th century.
They also didn't have Ambien then, and she talks about Ambien.
Yes. Well, that's
Jackie's ad lib. Yeah,
that was her. I mean, it may seem silly, but I thought having Dauntless have the glasses as well kind of ruined the joke with Winifred. So, just a minor thing. I found the production fitfully entertaining. I thought there were many moments where they really nailed it. Shy. Absolutely brought down the house. I saw it. I mean, I think people clapped for, I don't know, a minute and a half and whooping and cheering. It never quite reached that level again, but for whatever reason, it really clicked on that number, and she did a superb job with it. I had seen a one night benefit performance of the show that the Transport Group did about a year or so ago. And one thing that I did appreciate was that I thought that Lipsinka had really miscalculated in that one-nighter, because he did everything in that show very, very, very deadpan. I mean, totally deadpan. And I thought it really didn't work. It only worked for about 3 minutes, and then it was very boring. But here he had a lot more life and a lot more variation in his lines, and I appreciated that. Let's see. Oh, yeah. You know, I liked the way the orchestra sounded. And I guess they were mostly the orchestrations from the Broadway revival. But then Matt Castle, who was the musical director for this, had a hand in it, too, because it says orchestrations by Frank Galgano and Matt Castle. And Matt Castle was the musical director. And I have to say, I always liked his work in the past. I didn't think he did a good job at all. I thought a few of the tempos were way too slow. And one thing he allowed the cast to do, which drove me crazy, was to ruin some of the internal rhymes in those wonderful, wonderful Marshall Barrow lyrics. For example, in the song In a Little While, there is a line that goes, in a little while, just a little while, you and I will be 1, 2, 3, 4. In a little while, I will see your smile on the face of my son to be forever hand in glove. Well, that lyric is sung 3 times in the song, and every single time the people playing Harry and Larkin breathed and paused between son to be and forever. And it's just driving me crazy, because they really are brilliant. They're absolutely completely brilliant in terms of the wit and the interior rhymes. And it really bothered me that was ruined. And I'm very surprised that Matt Castle didn't know enough to tell them not to do that. So I had mixed feelings about it. I thought the idea of having projections on the back wall was really creative and worked very well for the most part. We actually saw them, drawings by Ken Fallon, and then a transparency would go up, and then he would fill in each scene, and you would see his hand filling them in. But the only problem with that was that it impacted on the lighting, because they had to try to light the cast in a certain way so as not to wash out the backdrop. And I thought that led to problems in that sense. So, I don't know, maybe a lot more money would have helped. it usually does. I thought it was that Jack Cummings, as the director, had a handle on some of it, but not all of it by any means. And it was still, for all that, far, far, far superior to the Broadway revival, which was a complete misfire. And it did show in many places what a wonderful show this is. And I guess I'm hoping for a perfect production of this some way, in the way that I've been hoping for a perfect production of West Side Story for so long.
Well, this production is playing through January 3rd, 2016, down at the Abrams Arts Center on Grand Street, and perhaps Transport Group could arrange some sort of sponsorship through Uber to get people from Midtown down to...
All the Transport Group. So transport us.
I think it's not so bad in terms of the actual distance, but as Carrie said, it there are no numbered streets down there.
I can't do it.
I tell you, this is such a first world problem for New Yorkers. So, like, you know, the people who are listening to us travel, 45 minutes to an hour to 2 hours to 3 hours to go see things, and we're talking about something that is from Midtown to Grand Street, probably 4 miles.
It's not distance. It's find my way around there. Come on.
That's why Uber.
I don't have the space on my phone for it. Speaking of problems. I don't have space for that app.
Not that many places to eat around there either, by the way.
Now we're talking a serious thing.
There's a wonderful chicken place that I found. I'll have to tell you.
I found an okay Mexican restaurant. Okay. That's the best I could do.
I found a really good chicken place down by Lazarus, by New York Theater Workshop.
Oh.
I couldn't find that chicken place again.
We should also say, though, that once you get into the theater at the Abrams Art Center, it's beautiful.
Very nice place, yeah.
I think that part of the reason it looks, like it's quite old and preserved in its original fashion, and probably wouldn't have been if it wasn't located where it is, so...
Which brings up, by the way, that King's Theater in Brooklyn. Did you go see Annie?
No, I was going to go see Annie. There's the tour of Annie that's playing the apparently magnificently restored King's Theater in Brooklyn. But the run was cut from, was it 2 weeks to one? Is that correct?
Yeah. They weren't doing business. But I did go on Thursday night, and what a theater.
Oh, my.
I mean, granted, the orchestra is awfully big. I mean, it goes back to double P. But they really restored it, sparing no expense. So it's great fun to be in there. Nice for those who are listening for this tour, who's coming to their city. By all means, it's an excellent production of Annie.
Oh, good.
Yeah, the Daddy Warbucks is one of the best I've ever seen. The Annie's very good, too. I do think it's worthy. I will say there's been a little bit of change here and there. A little word here, a little lyric there. A little bit of work done on the show, so it's not quite the Annie that you've known and either loved or hated. But 98% of it is at least the same.
And, it's directed by Martin Chardon, yes?
Yeah. I have one of two things happened. Either way back when he did it, Mike Nichols said, Marty, don't do that. And he didn't, and now he can. Or, actors make suggestions, and at this point he says, I'll leave it in. It's fine. Yeah, go ahead. So there have been tiny changes here and there. And, of course, Tom Mia may have had something to do with that, too, needless to say. But it's still a very slick, well-thought-out production. And for a Troika production, Troika is this does a lot of tours, and they've been known to do them on the cheap. Not this time. Not this time at all. Beowulf Borat, the Tony winner, has done a very, very nice series of sets. And I do think that... on tour, if there are kids who want to see this, and there were certainly a lot of kids in Brooklyn that night, by all means take them, because it's a quality work. And I can only hope the theater that you see it in is at least somewhat similar to the King's in Brooklyn, because they've really worked to make that one wonderful.
Well, this Annie Troika tour is going to Providence, Rhode Island, then Augusta, Georgia, Roanoke, Lexington, Lafayette, Louisiana, Oxford, Mississippi, Columbus, Georgia, Cleveland, Ohio, Tyler, Texas. It's making its way all around Mississippi, Texas, a lot of Texas, parts of Florida, Kentucky.
Tyler, Texas is Tommy Toon's hometown.
Oh, is it?
Say that five times fast, please. Carrie, please say that five. There's no P's in that one. All right. So, last week or the week before, I can't recall, we talked about China Doll and Lazarus and School of Rock, and Carrie saw all of those things. So let's do a lightning round with Carrie.
Oh, gosh.
Let's start off with China Doll. Do you have much to say about China Doll?
I don't know what it was about. I really don't.
All of us, none of us do.
I'm not as well versed in Mamet as some of my peers who have been in the industry a bit longer or studied a bit more extensively. But my main response to the show was that I cannot put 90 minutes to 2 hours worth of my time and sympathy into a character who's disrespectful to women and doesn't want to pay taxes. I just found the character to be incomprehensible and unsympathetic. I don't really understand the plot. I still don't after reading a lot of reviews from what I understood from the Times review. Ben Brantley didn't know either.
That was great. the way he wrote, at least I think that's what happens.
I have a tremendous amount of respect for Al Pacino, and I saw him do Shylock in The Park, and I saw him in the latest Glengarry revival, and there seemed to be a marked difference in his energy and his presence on stage from Glengarry to now, which was kind of sad because he is a genius. And if you look at the work he's done, I mean, I'd like to think there were reasons why he made the choices he did, but I wasn't able to understand them. I thought the set was beautiful. I'd love to live in that apartment. Mm. But I remember Mamet saying in one of the press, a quote from Mamet in one of the press releases was that the play is better than oral sex. And if that's the case, then Mr. Mamet needs a new partner. Because that was not. It just, I have no idea what I saw.
Oh, well, I think all of us had the same reaction to you. So since you couldn't figure out what happened in China Doll, you must have figured out what happened in Lazarus.
You have too much faith in me.
Because we too could not figure out what happened in Lazarus. So tell us what your take on Lazarus was at the New York Theater Workshop.
I saw China Doll in the middle of the week, and I saw Lazarus on a Saturday. And the main difference was that with China Doll, it greatly irritated me that I did not know what was going on, because this is a play by a respected playwright with a superstar actor and a house filled with people who'd paid a fortune to be there. And frankly, I didn't think that it was a play that should be on Broadway. When there are so many great works that are done off Broadway that deserve a house and an audience like that. But Agreed. Lazarus, I was okay with going on along for the ride, because that was a different play with a different show with a different intention. And I was able to just kind of lose myself in whatever the heck was going on up there. And also I could hear the actors, and I couldn't hear Pacino during much of China Doll. And I was sitting in the orchestra. But I thought that Michael C. Hall was outstanding. Michael Esper was fantastic. I mean, I wanted to see him and Raul Sparza do that Valentine's Day song, like as an intensity off between the two of them, because Raul Sparza was the only other actor I could imagine doing the song like that, just with that level of kind of mystery and sexuality. And I was able to just go along in kind of a flood of sensory images and sounds. But compared to China Doll, there was supposed to be a story there. And I really don't think there was supposed to be a story there with Lazarus. From what I did gather, the alien was trapped on Earth and drinking a lot of gin. And Michael Esper's character was killing lovers. I'm not exactly sure what Christian Milioti's character was supposed to be doing. But the little girl was... Mm. She's very good at playing dead girls. She was also in... that MCC show, I'm blanking on the name now, The Nether. She's very, very good at playing mysterious dead girls. But while I didn't know what had happened, it was still a pleasurable ride, just watching and absorbing. And I can't say the same from my time at China Doll.
All right. So making your way uptown a little bit, you got to Invisible Thread at the Second Stage Theater. So tell us about that.
Oh my gosh, that was a feast. Diane Paulus is directing at her best. It's an incredibly moving story about a young gay man who goes on a missionary trip, and after getting to know some of the locals there, really changes his life. It changes his life in remarkable ways, and he and his partner take it upon themselves to sort of sponsor the education of these children. And it went, they're very young, and it was just incredible to me to watch them, watch these young, young men take on this. At one point they joke, they say they haven't had sex in a month. And the other partner says, we have five kids. That's normal, because they've basically adopted these five teenagers. The music and the choreography is transporting to use that word again. It really takes you into this different cultural experience that is, it's vivid and colorful and fluid and earthy and organic and just everything that musical theater should be. It really is. And the night I was there, one of the writers who plays himself wasn't on, and his standby or alternate was on. I can't recall his name off the top of my head, but I never would have guessed that he was the alternate, because he was giving a great performance. And this, I don't want to spoil the plot of the story, but there are some twists and turns that really affected myself and my friend who were there. We both expressed a lot of surprise by what happens in the story, but along with a happily coherent and navigable story, it's just a feast for the senses. It really, really is. And just the way they make use of that space at Second Stage is theater production at its best. I can't say enough about it. I hope that it extends or moves uptown, because it is a story and a production that should be heard and seen and appreciated.
All right. So also, we talked about School of Rock. What did you think about School of Rock?
I was so surprised by how much I liked it. I actually have never seen the movie, and I'm not the biggest fan of Andrew Lloyd Webber. I have blogged about him a lot on my blog, carriepurcell.com. And well, every show is different, and I try not to go in with preconceived notions. If I had any, they were quickly taken away. I thought it was a really well done show. I've talked about being a band geek on here before, and I thought it showed how vitally important the arts are in young people's educations. I thought that Alex Brightman is a complete star. I can't even imagine doing what he does twice a day. He said in interviews that he's had to work to keep stay the weight he is and not lose weight by doing that show. So I wish I had his diet.
We discussed that.
We talked about that.
I can't imagine how that. I don't know how he does it.
I mean, he must be like keeping Shake Shack and Two Boots in business to talk about some restaurants that we know of within our 12 block radius that we're comfortable, or at least I'm comfortable in. Sierra Boggess was great. I wanted to see her do a bit more though, because I think she's so funny and so talented. To be able to do both opera and comedy the way she does is a real gift. And I want to adopt all those children. If they need a parent, I will adopt them happily. I especially liked, big surprise, the bossy little feminist girl.
Summer.
Yes. And I was so surprised that Julian Fellowes wrote that book. And I actually interviewed him about a week ago and asked him if he had written the word douchebag into the script, or if he had an advisor in American colloquialisms who told him to use that word. And he said he used it himself, which was really surprising. And I kind of wish he would slip that into Downton Abbey script just to take us all by shock. And it's a delight. It really is. It was moving and touching. And again, arts education needs more attention and funding. I can't say enough about that. And I wish that everyone, I wish there would be a Congress field trip to go see it. So they would pass a bill to give more arts education funding to schools, because that show really, it brought so much joy into everyone on stage as well as everyone in the audience. My friend at that show was doing what she calls an ugly cry throughout most of the second act. And I was getting a little misty eyed myself. And I really wish I could be as cool as that girl who plays the bass, because she's cooler than I will ever be. But it was a delightful, delightful surprise. And it just, that was the first show I ever saw, the first theater I ever saw a Broadway show in, when I was 7 years old, and my family took me to see Cats. So it was fun to be back there again as well.
All right. And to wrap up our catch-up, our quick round with Carrie.
Can I chime in with one more thing?
Sure, of course.
One criticism I have about School of Rock is I wish that the best friend's girlfriend had not been written to be such a stereotype of a shrew. I felt like she was plucked out of a Judd Apatow film where the women are just a pair of breasts that make a guy grow up. And that bothered me. I will say that bothered me. I wish she'd been made. I know they had to limit
both
it.
Both of those characters,
time.
Yeah.
Both of them, yes.
Both of those characters we talked about that were kind of, they're so one-dimensional and terrible stereotypes there.
And I know it was a long show already, and it's not like they could give her a lot of backstory, but that's why I don't watch Judd Apatow films anymore, because I'm just tired of seeing the harpy shrew who makes the guy grow up. And that could have been her billing in the playbill, and I'm sure that actress deserves more to work with.
I don't remember the movie well enough. Does anyone know if that character serves the same function in the movie?
I don't know. I don't remember.
Because I really hated the way it was written in the show. And also, did you notice how, as much as a villain as she is, but then she's notice how she's redeemed at the very end?
Because she likes rock.
Yeah, it's like it was so unconvincing, and so it wasn't at the level of the rest of the book. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, it kind of felt like either written early and then forgotten about, or slapped on at the end.
Yeah.
And to wrap up our quick round with Carrie, you saw Motherstruck, a culture project. Mm-hmm. So tell us about that.
Oh, it's fantastic! It's a one-woman show about a lesbian immigrant from Jamaica who decides to get pregnant through in vitro fertilization. And I say that five times quickly. No P's in it, but. And it's by Stacey Ann Chin, who's a writer, a spoken word poet, an activist. And it's just about her experiences. It's directed by Cynthia Nixon. And it's what an education about her life, about the politics of Jamaica and the LGBTQ community there. And also about, not an education for me because I'm well-versed in it, but hopefully an eye-opener for some people about health insurance. Because at one point, the first time she tries to get pregnant, she learns that she has a huge fibroid tumor on her ovaries and her health insurance won't cover the removal of it because it's an elective surgery. And then she basically bankrupts herself financially to have this child. And it's a very frank, unapologetic, blunt telling of her life, not asking for sympathy or pity, but just telling the facts as they happened. And then after the baby's born, being a single mother in a tiny Brooklyn apartment, being a lesbian, being a racial minority, everything, like every challenge that you could probably imagine, she has faced in one way or another. But it's inspiring. It's moving. I've actually interviewed Stacey Ann as well. And she and her daughter do these living room protests where they film themselves protesting one thing or another in their apartments. And there's a great one with them talking about Planned Parenthood and her daughter stating, "My body is my own." And it's a story that you don't necessarily see uptown or midtown. And I think it deserves to be told. And I think that she does an incredible job with it. And I consider myself pretty well versed in a lot of areas of social justice and political justice, but I learned a lot from those 2 hours. And it's very vivid and very, even though it's just one person and basically no set, she moves around a lot. She's an incredible performer. Very powerful, and I think that I know it was supposed to be done earlier and the production was postponed, and I'm very, very glad that it made its way to the Culture Project.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm not sure what happened with that. It struck me as odd because it's a one-person show, right? Mm. It sounded like money problems, but also the salient point here is that Rosie O'Donnell is a producer or the producer of it. So that doesn't quite answer Peter's earlier question because she's not in a show right now, but another actor sing.
Yeah, so I will have a link to the Culture Project website there. I've been frantically looking for a few minutes for an ending date here, and it's not on their site.
It's through January, the end of January.
Through the end of January? Okay.
Yes.
So check it out. Before we wrap up for the evening, I want to remind listeners that you could subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe button. Click that way each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway. It'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, or your Android device. And get a stream to you. Broadway World Radio plays this Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Carrie, for Peter, for Michael, and for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. Did I mention that the Transport Group had a video for Once Upon a Mattress from the concert back in... it's 2013. I guess they did it as a one-night concert thing.
Yeah, that's the one I was referring to. Are you saying...
Yeah. They have a video, yeah.
What do you mean, the whole thing?
No, just of Shy.
Oh, yeah.
Just of
Shy. And I meant to mention that for those who are interested, it's incredible what's on YouTube. The entire original television production of Once Upon a Mattress with Carol Burnett and Jane White and Jack Gilford from the original production is on YouTube.
Huh. We'll have to dig that up and put that in the show notes as well.
Yep.
All right. So, Peter... Do you have an answer to last week's trivia?
Yeah, I asked what these songs had in common. Not Anymore from Raisin, One Night in Bangkok from Chess, A Beat Behind in Paula from The Goodbye Girl, and Almost They Couldn't Compare to You from Out of This World. Mm-hmm. And the answer is that all of them mention Tony winners, because in Raisin, they mention Harry Belafonte. Mm-hmm. In Chess, they mention Yul Brynner. In A Beat Behind, Tommy Tune is mentioned. In Paula, Sondheim is mentioned. And in They Couldn't Compare to You, we hear of Essel Merman, because Cole Porter needed to rhyme it with Nestle. So that's why it's an almost. So Essel Merman. So that's the answer for this week. For next week... Of course, there have been hundreds of Broadway show songs that have dealt with Christmas in one way or another. But there is another day this week that has been celebrated in a show song in a hit musical. What is it?
All right. So if you have the answer to that, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com and we will... let you know if you hit on the right answer. So on behalf of Carrie Purcell, Michael Portantier, Peter Felicia, and me, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Videos This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Now listen, all you red hot lovers, you ought to know what to do.
December 10th on Broadway.